every decision you make impacts 150, 200 people, you know, you drive a lot of satisfaction in the impact you're making in your community, not to say our customers, which is 45 municipalities and hundreds and thousands of people who live in each of the municipalities as an indirect impact that you could make. That sometimes feels surreal, but the level of satisfaction I have doing this than any other corporate job that I've had in the past, there is no comparison, absolutely no comparison.
From SME Ventures, it's the Search Fund Podcast, a show about hungry entrepreneurs who, instead of starting a business, decide to buy one. These are their stories of success, failure, and the lessons they've learned. This is Jake Nicholson of SME Ventures, and on today's show, we're joined by Manny Saxena, an engineer turned search fund entrepreneur, one of the many, and CEO of Contract Sweeping Services. Manny's search fund path was fairly unique in that it culminated in two acquisitions from the same owner right at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. In this episode, he discusses how he recognized and realized synergies across both companies and how he's driven value creation post-acquisition. We even touch on the implications of his visa status on his entrepreneurial journey. Manny, thank you so much for joining today. Very excited to talk to you. Just spoke with your colleague Mia recently from Broadtree, and maybe there will be more Broadtree alumni coming through here, but you have a pretty unique story, and I'm eager to get into it today.
My pleasure, Jake. Thanks for having me.
Let's start from the beginning, Manny. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in India. Like most other Indians in the US, was an engineer by background. You know, came to the U.S. for my MBA, went to Northwestern Kellogg in 2012.
What was your childhood like? What were you like as a kid?
So my dad was in the army in India, which meant that we had to travel a lot. We basically moved places every year, sometimes sooner, which, you know, meant I changed 12 schools growing up. Wow. And when I look back at that time, I feel like at the time felt incredibly frustrating because, you know, it took about that much time to make friends. Mm. And as you were getting into your thick of friendship, you learned dad got transferred again. But in the hindsight, I felt like that gave me a lot of qualities, which I think have served me well, especially now in the search world. One was just flexibility. I got flexible and basically didn't mind a lot of changes in my life, which if you talk to any CEO operator in the search world, every day is a new day. You got to adjust and adapt. And then the other piece was I learned to make relationships quickly and realized that time was of the essence when you talk to people to create that connection. Which really served me well through my search days when I was talking to CEOs, owners, dozens of owners every week to make that relationship quickly. And then we didn't have a lot of resources or money growing up, you know, government paycheck for my dad, which instilled, you know, just being careful with money, which again serves you well when you're serving, when you're, you know, running a small business. So all those things, I'm really happy that I got that exposure growing up, and it certainly is something that I use on a day-to-day basis right now.
Were you a good student?
I define good, I guess. I was never the topper, but I was usually, you know, in top three, top five students because I was a lot into sports growing up. I had, you know, divided my time between sports and studies. So that, and then obviously was really interested in the physics, chemistry, maths side of things, and hence became the engineer and got incredibly lucky along with the hard work also to get into a pretty coveted engineering school in India called the Indian Institute of Technology. So from that perspective, yes, you can say I was a good student, but never loved studying. I liked the schoolwork specifically growing up.
Tell me about IIT a little bit. You did a bachelor in technology. What does that mean? What kind of technology?
So it's basically an engineering degree, like BS in the US. It's a four-year course. And I did material science engineering at IIT Varanasi, which is in the middle of India, and spent about 4 years there and wanted to experiment or keep working in my core field. So basically joined a huge manufacturing plant of power equipment manufacturer, more on the side where they used a lot of different types of materials right after my engineering days. But yeah, that was kind of, material science was was maybe not my first love, but definitely my first foray into the professional world.
And on the side, you were captain of the swimming team?
I was, but I do want to say this, that captain of swimming team, I actually represented my state also in India, but being anything at that point, specifically in swimming, because there was so less competition, because it's not a very popular sport, is not a big deal. So I do not want your audience to have any comparisons between what they expect of a swimming captain here in a varsity team versus there.
You're so modest. So you went to this manufacturer out of university, and from what I can tell, pretty electric start to your career. You were chief of staff to the CEO of a $10 billion company in India, which is an even bigger deal than a $10 billion company in the US. How did that happen?
So I started off in the manufacturing division on the manufacturing floor as my first job out of undergrad. And spent a good year there and then got transferred to the corporate office of that company and really was not necessarily the chief of staff, but in the secretariat of the C-level executives in that $10 billion company. And that was partly because they were looking for somebody young who had some experience in the manufacturing divisions in the company. And then I think I also got lucky to get that role. And then I feel like the role was pivotal in helping me understand that I was more of a business guy than an engineer, because the work that I was doing there was helping the C-level executive evaluate investments in different types of technology systems across the company. And basically, cool projects across the company found its way to us in terms of getting approved by the CEO, by the director at that point of that company. And we were basically ones who were evaluating each of those projects and recommending investment or no investment for these different projects that came across the company. So, you know, that made me get into the world of IRR, NPV, you know, looking at cash flow projections, figuring out competitive dynamics across the landscape in India. I felt like I was more of a natural there. And hence, after spending about two and a half years there, I realized it was about time for me to go get business school education, and what better country to have that education than the US. So hence started looking for schools in the US.
It's interesting, you mentioned you found you were more a natural fit with the business side of things than the manufacturing engineering side of things. A lot of searchers, I think a lot of entrepreneurs in general, are trained as engineers and then they transition to the business side. And sometimes people see those as two very different worlds, business thinking and engineer type thinking. What do you mean when you say that it was more of a natural fit for you, the business side of things? And were you able to draw on your engineering training as a business operator?
Yeah, so I think that's interesting, because I've seen, even in Broadtree, you talked about Mia, who's also an engineer, and then we had another cohort mate of ours called Paige. She's also an engineer. I feel like as an engineer, there's a lot of qualities that you pick up, being analytically smart or rigorous, attention to detail, things like that really help in you in running business. But for me, I felt like the biggest thing was I was more of a broad skill set person, where I could do a lot of things reasonably well, versus a person who would be really great at one thing, which is, you know, engineering. And for you to be a great engineer, I think as time passes in that field, you got to be really good at one thing and kind of hone in on what your specialty is and then become an expert in that, right? And I was never interested in that. I just wanted to be, I guess I didn't have the patience to be really good at one thing. I just wanted to be reasonably good at a lot of different things. And that's kind of what you want to be as a CEO operator as well. Like I can do, you know, cash flow projections. I can do LBO models. I can read the balance sheet, you know. But if you asked me for this specific type of transaction, how it kind of lead into our accounting software. I may not be able to tell you the right answer every time, but I intuitively understand how the three statements work. That's the kind of the person I am. And I really wanted to kind of get to a profession where I would be really good at being whatever I did, like a business guy, a CEO, than being an average engineer.
So your next step then is Kellogg at Northwestern University to get your MBA. At what point did you start thinking that you wanted to do something entrepreneurial or run your own business?
So I came in really, I'd say, underconfident in the US, primarily because this was a new country. A lot of my classmates, you know, were consultants, bankers, private equity folks. And me coming in with no business background really felt like I was underprepared to jump into the world of business, let alone entrepreneurship. But that was something that I was always interested in. And so I incidentally was studying abroad in Barcelona at IESE school, and I got into a class called Search Fund that was taught by Peter Kelly, which was completely alien concept to me when I got the class. But by the end of the class, I kind of knew that that's what I really wanted to do, because what attracted me to entrepreneurship was more that I wanted to work with people. I wanted to work in teams. I wanted to create a vision, get people excited about that vision. And that's where my pleasure of working or starting a company or entrepreneurship lay. And I was not that interested in product market fit or raising money, or, you know, comes along with, you know, starting a hot new startup in the Bay Area in Silicon Valley comes with. So for me, entrepreneurship through acquisition was love at first sight. I was realistic enough to know that I had to get a few years of experience under my belt before I could go out and run a business and convince people to invest with me, like investors, and have the confidence to command or work at the helm of, you know, 100, 200 people, organizations. So that's what I did.
And yet you decided not to launch a search fund right away after business school. It wouldn't be till several years later that you did that. Why not? Why didn't you go right into it?
I mean, there are tactical reasons. One was I was on a visa. I still am. And in case not a lot of viewers know about this, but it's not the easiest to work for yourself on a work visa. And that was one of the biggest issue. Mm-hmm. And then the second one was basically what I said earlier. I wanted to get some experience under my belt before I went out to raise money and ask for and get into the world of search funds.
So you go to Sears Holdings and you're essentially involved in turnarounds. What was the scope of that position and what did you learn?
Yeah, so I wanted to realize that if I wanted to get some business exposure, when I say business exposure, the act of implementation and operations more so than, you know, the strategy world, which is a lot of what business school students do joining consulting, I realized getting into a place, going into a place which had a lot of problems would give me good exposure on dealing with those problems. And Sears at the time and still had a lot of problems. It was a $30, $35 billion company, a revenue company, and had a lot of issues, legacy issues, and new competition and the likes of, you know, Amazon, Target, and whatnot that they were dealing with. So I realized joining them would be a great learning opportunity. And that too in a role that they had called Senior Leadership Program, which is basically a leadership program, which was directly under the holding company of the company. And you went in almost like an internal consulting gig. You go in and work on different projects. So one day it's marketing, the second day it's, you know, store operations, the third day it could be pricing. So you really got a good, and these projects were more implementation projects, not strategy projects, right? So you spend about 3 to 6 months there and you basically try and figure out what the root cause of the problem is and improve the functioning of the organization. And that was, you know, I wanted business experience. That was basically baptism by fire. And I spent multiple roles in the organization and eventually found home in their marketing division. I was the senior director of marketing of all their underperforming stores, which is a lot of stores. Got a chance to really manage a large team and a large budget, presenting to the CEO of, you know, $30 billion company on a weekly basis. You know, absolutely loved my time there. There were plenty of smart people there who I learned a lot from. I just feel like the experience I got there, because it was a struggling retailer, was so much more richer than I would have gotten at a place like, let's say, Target or Amazon or, you know, any of the large retailers that were not struggling, which would have given me a 10 by 10 matrix of what needed to work and not really provide me the freedom to think outside the box and, you know, really experiment within my role, within my organization. So definitely would never take anything away from that experience. And I do think I'm a better operator today because of my time up at Sears.
Fairly entrepreneurial, it sounds. You were given the ability to really take ownership of some projects. Did you start developing some confidence that maybe you might be getting closer to CEO ready?
I did, especially my last role there when I was presenting to the CEO of Sears Holdings Corporation every week, which was Eddie Lampert, the CEO of the company. Initially, the first, call it 2 to 3 months, I definitely felt out of element. And I felt like it was something that was not natural to me. I had to write in literally every word I used to present. But slowly but steadily, you know, when you learn that the conversations that are happening at the top level are not that different from the conversations you're having with, let's say, your boss or your peers, your colleagues, you start to gain confidence that there's no such thing as a genius or no such thing as somebody who was so much better than you that you needed to think badly about yourself, right? So that really propelled me to think about the fact that I could have a place in what I was doing. And since I was putting in the hard work and, you know, looking at every project I got, both analytically and figuring out ways to implement the strategies that we were creating, I was someone who could, you know, make change happen. And that was, I think, one of the biggest turning point in terms of me gathering the confidence that, hey, I think it's time to start thinking about buying my own business and running that business.
Great. There was one more stop on your way to launching a search fund, and that was at a company called Persado. It seems you essentially had a sales role there. Is that right? Was that a deliberate decision? You saw it was a gap in your skill set, or how did that happen?
Yeah. So when I was nearing my 3-year stint at Sears, I started to think about search funds. And then out of the blue, I got an opportunity at this hot Series C startup funded by Goldman, really doing well, to come in and do sales for them. And the reason they reached out to me specifically was because I was their customer at Sears.
Got it.
So they were one of our vendors, and they had actually performed really well through our marketing channels. And they just wanted me to come on board. And I spoke to the sales leader up at Persado. And I was like, you know, I'm a brown kid from India. You don't typically reach out to, you know, engineer students coming in or having spent a lot of time in general management to go to sales. So why me? And he replied that, man, if you're looking, this is a very consultative sales approach. And it was a $1 million product. So we needed people who had credibility. We needed people who had used the product before. We needed people who could understand the problems of the customer and then suggest a part of the product that could act as a solution for those customers. So I think you'd be great at that job. And the way I thought about this opportunity was I thought this would be a phenomenal training for me in sales because I'd never done sales before. And I'd heard from a lot of people that it's an experience that sales is an experience that every professional should undertake. And it is, you learn a lot. And I felt like when I joined the company, that was an understatement. I felt like it's the most humbling thing you do. And then it prepares you so much better for your professional life. Because at the end of the day, as a CEO, a lot of your job is sales. You know, whether you're selling to your customers, that's an obvious thing you do, but you're also selling to your employees, you're selling to your investors, you're selling to the bank, you're selling to all the different stakeholders that you can think of in any business setting, almost 80% of your time. So I think having done that for a little under a year, it gave me the building blocks of, you know, what do we need as somebody who doesn't do sales as a full-time job, but also knows that he uses the skill set for his daily functioning. So that's why I chose to take that. But because I knew I was going to do search fund, by no means was it a foray into sales as a long-term career. But I think spending a year gives you like in my mind, a good chunk of what is needed to be a good salesman, which will be helpful for me. It was basically picking up a skill set, which I thought was super important for whatever I did for the rest of my life.
I often tell prospective searchers that the CEO is often the company's number one salesperson. And it baffles me that sales is so underemphasized in business school, because it's kind of important to a business, you know, to generate sales. And as you mentioned, not just the literal definition, but selling to all stakeholders involved in the operation of a company. Super important. So then you feel you have the pieces in place, you have the confidence, you have the operating experience, you have the CEO exposure, you have the sales experience, you have the engineering degree and the MBA, and now it's time to go buy a company for yourself. And you choose to work with Broadtree. I'm a fan of David and his team. As I mentioned, talked to Mia Jackson, your colleague, just recently. And I think Broadtree has about 10 acquisitions under its belt now. Is that right?
Yeah, something like that. Every few months, you know, they do an acquisition or two. So they're making good progress. Yeah.
Yeah. In any case, the process worked and you acquired two companies, Statewide Construction Sweeping and Contract Sweeping Services, right?
Yes.
What do these companies do, at the risk of stating the obvious?
Yeah. So Contract Sweeping Services, first of all, these two companies were bought from the same owners, even though they were completely different companies. They were bought from the same owners, which made it a little bit easier for us to buy both companies simultaneously. So I don't want people to think that, hey, this is also something we should do or something that one can even aim to do, because it's not easy to close two companies simultaneously. But Contract Sweeping Services, we have longstanding contracts with municipalities, counties, cities to sweep their streets and highways and roads on a recurring basis. So wherever you're at, there's probably a street sweeper that comes by and you get really annoyed because you have to move your car for the street sweeper. And so the street sweeper is us. The enforcement of parking is not us, so don't hate us for that. So these are like longstanding contracts, 3, 5, 10, 15 years contracts with municipalities across, at the time, Northern California, where we own 70% of the market, you know, all the big counties and cities and towns that you can think of in Northern California that have a outsourced sweeping program. We probably did those, you know, city of Palo Alto, city of San Ramon, Napa, you know, Stockton, Livermore. You think of a city, we probably do it. So that was what contract sweeping was. The biggest thing there was recurring revenue, obviously, and you knew exactly where the next year, how much you would be billing to each of those customers you had. But the issue there was always kind of from a cost perspective, you just needed to make sure the trains ran on time and the cost didn't go out of whack. So that was kind of contract sweeping. Statewide Construction Sweeping, the second business we bought, in my opinion, as different as it can be from contract sweeping in so many different ways, even though they both were in sweeping. Statewide Sweeping basically was a service that we charged our customer hourly rates on, where large sweepers would go out on roadway and highway construction sites, typically, or construction in general. And our sweepers would go out there and sweep, you know, dust or, you know, debris out before there was, you know, stormwater runoffs. And that hence could impact water table and get pollution. So basically, that was regulatorily mandated service. Also, no contracts, only repeat business, generally to general contractors of roadway and highway construction. And the other interesting piece was contract sweeping was an open shop, whereas Statewide was a union shop. So that was another flavor of differentiation between the two companies. Combined revenue of about $23 million at the time, and then about $4.5 million EBITDA when we bought the companies.
So let's dwell a little bit on this idea of buying two companies. You've highlighted the differences between the two, different revenue models, different customer bases. Are there some synergies there that make it feasible for you, particularly as a first-time CEO, to successfully manage both of them?
Yes. They had synergies as well. And the biggest one was, I think, financial synergies, where contract sweeping's biggest months were during the winter or fall when the leaves went fell down and we had more revenue coming in because we had more routes. And Statewide was basically construction oriented. So they basically kind of shut down a lot, or slowed down a lot during winter season, but picked up again during construction season, which is typically summers. So that was an obvious financial synergy where you always had cash coming in of the business from the, and then the kind of related to that, you also had, you know, CapEx lines that you have, we had negotiated from the banks, which helped a lot knowing that we had a big business because some of these trucks are $300,000 and are extremely expensive. And hence, you know, having a bigger CapEx line and having the covenants to help support that CapEx line or our term loan was really helpful to have a bigger base. Some of the other synergies were more on the backend side, where we could have potentially one common team in terms of certain functions which were not key to the operations of the company, and then basically back charge each company based on the services that they did. Those were kind of two obvious ones. Other than that, I did think that there were not so many synergies that we could tap into, primarily because we are running a double-breasted operation, which basically means you have the same ownership for a union and non-union shop. So there are legal guidelines around what you can consolidate versus not. And we adhere to those very strictly. So we keep everything separate. We have a different yard. We have different employees. We have different operational staff. So everything is very separate.
So you bought in the fall of 2020 during COVID, which, to say the least, has been a tough time for many. I assume it has been for you as well, though I bet you're somewhat protected due to the nature of the recurring contracts, at least on for one of the businesses. But I'm sure you've been hit. Can you give us a couple of examples of how and when COVID has been really tangible in the running of these two businesses?
Yeah. So to what you said earlier, on the contract sweeping side where we have contracts, we didn't miss a beat. Nothing changed at all. We didn't even lower our frequency because the services we perform are not just for the streets to look pretty, but they're also has some significant safety and health benefits for the city and its residents. So nothing changed at all from that perspective. On the Statewide side, however, there were a couple of months where we slowed down significantly, primarily because construction was shut down in the Bay Area. This was right around April, May, June, which impacted the business. This I'm talking about 2020 significantly, but then it jumped right back in July when construction was open. And then the government kind of decided that even through COVID shutdowns, there were some key construction projects that will keep going. Mm. That almost like we got a sense of like what the downside could look like in one business. When we closed in fall, we already knew it was like 20-30%, but that was the extent of it. And then we saw a lot of those projects kind of just get shifted or moved to later months and not get canceled completely. Mm-hmm. That was another kind of confidence builder as we bought the businesses in fall. What's interesting has been the aftermath of COVID. That's been impacted us a little bit more than the actual COVID, primarily in terms of some of the long tails that has followed COVID, like, you know, the price increases in across different categories, including fuel. Fuel is a big portion of what we do. You know, almost 7-9% of our revenue is fuel, which is obviously, if you have a car, basically doubled since the last 1 year. Other things like brooms and tires are getting more and more expensive. The repair and maintenance parts, you know, if you've been following what's happening in the automotive industry, are extremely hard to come by now because of the supply chain issues around the world. And because of that, we have to stock a lot more parts and pay 30, 40, 50% more to get that stock or secure that stock in the first place. Sometimes trucks have to sit for months or weeks at least before they're repaired. So those are some of the things that we're kind of dealing with now than the actual COVID time, which is the peak time, which you would regard as 2020 and early part of 2021.
You're a year in, approximately. Aside from putting out the COVID-related fires, what levers are you pulling to create value in the business?
Trying to wrap my head around two businesses. That itself, it has not been an easy thing to do. You know, you almost have, it's a different culture as well, right? So you almost have to wear a completely different hat as you're tackling with issues with each company. have a separate KPI structure, have a different team structure, different controls to be put in place as you manage your business across both sides. So that itself took a few months. And then after that, I think one of the things that I really wanted to do as we spent time on understanding the business and as we kind of laid low in terms of investments we made through COVID was acquiring another business. So as luck would have it, we started talking to one of our biggest competitor on the statewide side in the Sacramento area, which would have been a normal, natural geography for us to expand to from Bay Area. We started talking to that competitor, and the company is called Shremi Sweeping Service. And they liked our idea. They liked the direction we had taken, and they had heard good things from the previous sellers of these two businesses. So started engaging conversations with them in terms of acquisition of that company. And we actually closed that acquisition October 26th. So right around 1 year after we had acquired the first two businesses. And now in the past 2-3 weeks, we are spending time on integrating that business with statewide and trying to figure out our organic growth strategy in areas close to these two locations. So a lot of my time, was spent in acquisition of that company because that was a proprietary deal as well. Most of your listeners, I'm sure, know proprietary deals are great because you get a great deal, but also they sometimes can act as a source of a lot of frustration and consume a lot of time. So it took us about 6 months basically to close that deal. But I'm so happy we did that deal. And I feel like the owners of that company have stuck around and become employees of ours going forward and rolled a significant chunk of their proceeds back in the business. So really trusting our growth strategy and our team in terms of taking their business to the next level.
Fantastic. Are you able to tell us, relative to your existing revenue base, how much that acquisition added?
Yeah, it was about $8 million revenue, $2 million EBITDA, approximately.
Exciting. Has there been an element of tech enablement to your value creation as well?
Yes. So that was basically a big portion of what we did when we came on board, primarily because the previous owners were not as tech savvy like a lot of search deals. And then Sweeping industry in general is probably not known for being too tech forward to begin with.
There's no sweep tech industry?
There's no sweep tech until now, even though we're half an hour from the Silicon Valley. There's unfortunately haven't been any unicorns lately in the sweep tech world. So there was a lot to do, and that's something we felt comfortable making those changes because business had gotten to a size where it was already kind of demanding that. So, the first thing we'd really put into place was a fleet management software, which is basically like the ERP system for other companies. So it's basically the heart of a lot of what we do on the fleet maintenance and telematics side in our day-to-day business. And I can get into that if you want me to, but that was one big thing that we did. We also, there were the procedures for accounts payables was very rudimentary in that the previous sellers basically approved everything in the past. And that was a culture shift as well. But we brought on a system called Bill.com, which is pretty popular amongst a lot of companies that basically made all our payables completely paper free. I signed about 50 checks a week when I joined. I signed one check a month now in the past 1 year. That was a huge improvement that we felt from a payables perspective. And then we were in the construction industry, so receivables sometimes became an issue and were outstanding for longer than you'd want it to be. So we got a software called AR Collect, which basically helped us reduce our AR outstanding and hence really reduce our working capital from last year significantly. And then now what we are doing is we just okayed a CRM system with Salesforce and a whole dispatch module within Salesforce. And we're actually proprietarily building that system as we speak for the past couple months. And once we have that, we could literally have drivers on tablets where they could get signatures of their customers on the construction yard so that there's no back and forth of the paper. Payroll is solved for. And then also use that same system for billing, connecting with our accounting system. that's a very anticipated project, and we really look forward to having that completed, hopefully in Q1 of next year. So there's a lot, as you can tell, there's a lot of activity that's gone on in the past 1 year and making a change in an organization, which has not been that tech savvy in the past, has been a lot of work in terms of both implementing the systems, but also changing the culture within the organization to be able to utilize those systems that we put in place.
Yeah, kudos to you. Sounds like you've tackled quite a bit successfully, so very impressive. Next question is a bit sensitive, so hopefully you're okay with it. These are obviously not only economically, but also politically and socially turbulent times, particularly in the United States. As you mentioned, you're on a visa. You're an immigrant to the United States, and I would love to hear from you how, if at all, but you are in Northern California, which is fairly progressive and diverse, but have you felt, how, if at all, has your immigrant status affected your search and operational efforts?
Yeah, no, I'm happy to talk about it, primarily because it's something that's not as talked about, because it's a small portion of the population that gets impacted, but it is significant impact on the people who do get impacted. I almost feel like, you know, over the years, I've been in the country for 9 years now, and came in 2012. Visa has had a continuous and significant mind share of my everyday life,
right,
all throughout. And it's something that's not just a problem that you have to overcome, an issue you have to overcome, but it's existential, right? To give you an example, even at this level, let's say I get fired from my job here, I have something like 3 months or 2 months, I think it is, to find another job. Otherwise, I literally have to leave the country. I can't start my own business on my work visa. So I have to find ways where there's a sponsor backing me at all times, whether it's a Broadtree or if it's a contract sweeping. And it's not easy to get, it's not easy, and basically extremely hard, I'd say borderline impossible, to ever start my own company where I own more than 50% of the company. So hence, for me, traditional search model and self-funded search models were completely not available. So the only way I could have done search would be to join forces with a company like Broadtree. Right. And still, like, when you, after having put in the effort, spending 2 years to buy these two businesses, transferring over my work visa from Broadtree to contract sweeping itself was not, that's also, there's a probability involved there.
Right.
Right. And so there could have been a world where I spent 2 years trying to do this, and then when it came time to it, I couldn't get the visa, so I couldn't run the business that I spent 2 years buying. Right. So there's all kinds of, like, these binary existential issues, which are always back of your mind and are extremely stressful. But, you know, like anything else, you got to take them, get a good lawyer. That's one. And second is take it in the right spirits and move on and keep doing it until you can't. And then obviously coming into an industry which is, you know, pretty blue collared, poses its own challenges. I don't think there's any other brown person, or at least Indian person, in the entire organization of, you know, 150 to 200 people that we have.
Wow.
So that cultural challenge was also there to be, I had to recognize that and temper my interactions with what I call is the real America, because that's what largely US is comprised of, not the business school like friends that I had, and, you know, work with them, right? And establish credibility to begin with, gain some experience, make data-driven decisions, without making it personal about any one thing. And, you know, COVID obviously has not posed unique challenges with that, right? Not everyone in the country, as you know, wants to get vaccinated. That has been, you know, issues in our company that we had to find ways to get around. Per OSHA, you know, now we need a company with over 100 employees, you need to either mandate vaccinations or need to be able to test routinely. You know, the obvious question becomes, if you mandate it, I don't know what percentage of staff I'll lose based on that.
Mm-hmm.
But if I didn't mandate it, then who's going to pay for the cost of testing every week?
Right.
You know, it's not going to be insignificant. So there are unique challenges that come along with that. But, you know, like anything else, I think it's one of the things that I have to deal with on a regular basis. But I feel like when you peel off the differences, in this case, my me being an immigrant, at a raw level, human beings are pretty much the same. They like the same things. They love the same things. They hate the same things in a lot of ways. And it's just understanding the real human behind that skin that becomes more important. And I've spent time trying to do that. And that kind of ties back to my experience growing up, where I dealt with new friends every year, new people everywhere, and trying to figure out common things that united us more than things that divided us. So that's kind of the mantra that I live with. And that's really helped serve me well.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you. When you started on this journey to business acquisition, you had some goals in mind, presumably. Do you feel like this is it? You're running this business is the culmination of your dreams and the achievement of those goals, or do you still have more things in your career you want to accomplish after this stage?
Yeah, so I'd start off with saying that it's definitely something that I felt the most satisfied and most, I guess, for lack of a better word, realized that I feel doing, because not to sound vain about this, but when your every decision you make impacts 150, 200 people, you know, you drive a lot of satisfaction in the impact you're making in your community, not to say our customers, which is 45 municipalities and hundreds and thousands of people who live in each of the municipalities, as an indirect impact that you could make. That sometimes feels surreal, but the level of satisfaction I have doing this than any other corporate job that I've had in the past, there is no comparisons. Absolutely no comparisons. I feel like this is small business world is an industry, if I might call it that, that is here to stay. Not just here to stay, but it is a huge, huge opportunity. Trillions of dollars of wealth is going to be transferred over from baby boomers to the next generation in the next 10 years. And all the money that private equities have, which is again, trillions of dollars of dry powder, don't have a scalable way to actually get to the small businesses, because their teams are not set up in that ways. So I think there's a huge opportunity being in the small business world here in the US, both from a financial standpoint, a financial return standpoint, but also impact standpoint, because, you know, something like 60, 65% of the US is comprised of the small businesses. So I would love to do a lot, play a bigger role in that ecosystem. And I do think this is just a start. And having the experience of searching and then running and then hopefully someday selling the business and creating the network around the search fund and ETA community, a small business community, is going to serve me well to get me to the next stage, whatever that might look like. But again, don't want to jump the gun. There still needs to be a lot of things that need to happen for my next stage. So I'm completely focused on what I'm doing day to day here.
Our listeners are, many of them are prospective searchers around the world, some in countries that are brand new to search funds, and they're just learning what this ecosystem is about. What would you like to share with these aspiring entrepreneurs that you wish you had known when you were weighing the pros and cons of launching a search fund?
Yeah, I think a lot of things I would say would sound cliched, but I'll say it anyways. One is you really need to understand the why of why you're doing this, right? You know, if it's being getting a fancy title or making some money or, you know, appearing cool, I don't know if that's the right reason to do this, right? Like money, you could probably make a little bit more money doing something else. Title wanes off really fast when you have the fourth HR issue of the week. So, you know, I would really, really encourage people to understand their why. And the way you can understand the why is by using or by living the life of a searcher and living the life of an operator. So I would highly recommend people who really want to are considering this as a life path to spend some, like an internship or spend some time with a searcher and an operator and, you know, and work on the problems that the operator and the searchers are working on firsthand. Outside of that, at least that's how I think about things, create like a matrix of every kind of person you can meet in the search fund community and talk to them, right? So if it's a searcher in like traditional search path, a self-funded search path, an accelerator search path, an investor, an operator, somebody who was successful in search, somebody who was unsuccessful in search, are all the variables of the different types of people, like banks, service providers. Again, variables of people you can talk to on a regular basis, talk to understand, you know, what the search life looks like, is extremely important. So talk to at least 30, 40, 50 different stakeholders, in my opinion, and make it almost like a regiment before you think you know it well enough that you don't need to talk to more people. And then the second thing I'd say is, like, just try and go abroad. Like, and I think that served me well, and I would recommend it to anybody who listens, is you don't need to be an expert in finance, but you need to know how to look at your financial statements, your balance sheet, do basic corporate finance functions. You don't need to be an expert in HR, but you need to understand the basics of it. Again, same goes for operations. So if you're in business school, you know, try and do a lot of different types of classes, a lot of classes that you don't think are really that necessary or sounds squishy are actually the ones that I thought were really interesting and important to be running a small business, like negotiations. So it was a class that I took at Kellogg, which was huge. You know, Morse was a class at Kellogg, which is basically more kind of the EQ piece of how you deal with people. Creativity, that was not the name of the class, but I definitely took a class or two on inspiring creativity in the organization. So things like that, I think, go a long way. And then really think about the model you want to work in, right? Like, once you talk to those people, you understand, you know, do you want to be king or do you want the cash, right? Like, when I say that, that means it's like you get the self-funded model where, you know, you would own 60, 70, 80% of the business and you're owner day one. It's a different kind of, you know, lifestyle, so to say, versus like kind of something like what I'm doing, maybe a larger business than a self-funded deal and institutional or sophisticated investors behind me, having a board who can hire or fire me. You know, it's a little bit different type of experience. So maybe really, really think hard on what your life needs to look like post-close. So all those things I'd say really would help in choosing the right path. And if not, letting you know that this is not the right path for you, which I think is equally important in the pursuit of what you want to do with your life.
Manny, thank you so much. Words of wisdom. Very valuable to hear your story for our listeners around the world. Best of luck in the coming years in the sweeping industry. You've already made some pretty big moves and we're excited to see more.
Yep. Thanks for having me and kudos to what you're doing. I think it's a noble job and work that you do. And I did not have any of these resources when I was considering search. So congratulations on what you've built, and I'll always be a supporter for you and your organization. And thanks for having me.
Since this interview with Manny, just less than 2 years post-acquisition, Manny has sold both companies and is now beginning his new journey at Sweeping Contractors of America, America's largest power sweeping company. I don't know what's next for Mr. Saxena, but with this win under his belt, I'm sure it will be worth following. Thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, you can find more at thesearchfundblog.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Jake Nicholson of SME Ventures, and you're listening to The Search Fund Podcast.